Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. And if I sound unusually happy, it's because I finally succeeded at making this technology work.
Well, you know, that's the trouble with technology. Sometimes it doesn't want to do what you want it to.
That is true. So we have a guest today who's going to talk about her book, of course, like our guests usually do. But one thing that's a little different is this book is about mothers and daughters, and it's a memoir. And, of course, Mom and I are mother and daughter. And so we have kind of a special connection here.
Right.
Yeah. And our author is Allie Rowbottom. She received her BA from New York University, her MFA from the California Institute of the Arts, and her PhD in creative writing and literature from the University of Houston, where she won quite a number of awards. Her work has received scholarships, prizes, and honorable mentions from all over, and she lives and writes in Los Angeles. And the title of her book is Jell-O Girls. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Allie.
Thank you for having me. It's so good to be here.
So, Jell-O Girls has, as a book, as a memoir, has kind of a long history, doesn't it?
Well, it starts in 1899 when my great-great-uncle bought the patent to Jell-O from its inventor for $450. That's sort of one thread of the book. And then another beginning of the book is really in 1945 when my mother was born. So it expands generations for sure. I sort of think of it as an epic in some ways, and still ongoing even past the last page, at least for me.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, sure.
Of course. And now, if I understand it, your mother started writing her memoirs and worked on it for quite a few years.
That's correct. Yeah, she started writing in the early 90s when I was just a little girl, and continued for the rest of her life. She died in 2015. So she wrote pretty feverishly for decades. But, you know, it was a challenge for her. I think although she was a great writer, a lot of her work was so verbose and detailed that it just didn't really move forward narratively. So it was always this sort of a struggle for her to find readers. And it was a gift to me in some ways, but also a challenge that she left me her memoir and sort of asked me to finish the story that she couldn't.
We want to talk about the story, but I also want to talk about how you worked with that material, which must have been reams of material, to create your own narrative.
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge. I mean, like I said, she wrote very feverishly. And in the end, you know, she left me boxes and boxes of her work. So sifting through it and really like carving from it a narrative was the biggest challenge of working with the material, aside from having to read sort of all of the grisly details of my mother's life, which, although fascinating, you know, it's hard for a kid, even an adult one, to read about their parents' lives in traumas, I think. So there was that part, but it was also really about winnowing, I think, in the end.
Of course. Yeah, definitely. So,
and then all the history about Jell-O. that was amazing. That was just amazing.
Thank
you.
Did you grow up like sort of being aware of all that history, or did that require a lot of research too?
That required a lot of research. I mean, I grew up knowing about our connection to Jell-O, but I think, like, you know, probably to my own benefit, wasn't really steeped in Jell-O culture. My mom tended to avoid it and sort of wanted to make a life outside of that legacy. So when it came time to make Jell-O a character in this book, I had to really work to figure out where it came from and what it was all about. And ultimately, it was that research and the story that sort of emerged from Jello's relationship with America and more than American feminism. It was that narrative that helped me figure out what to keep and what to omit from my mom's memoir.
Ah, okay.
And then
it's a fascinating story.
You frame it within this other kind of more current event as well, where in the Leroy, New York, the birthplace of Jell-O, tell us what happened there in 2011, 2012, and how that impacted your story.
Sure. So in October of 2011 and extending into 2012, a group of girls in Leroy came down with sort of undiagnosable and mysterious Tourette's-like symptoms. And at first it was just sort of confined to one girl and then two, but ultimately those symptoms ended up spreading mysteriously and with no known physical cause amongst a large group of girls and ultimately at least one woman. And about this, you know, the media said many things. It sort of descended on the town. The townspeople were very concerned about what could possibly be causing this illness amongst the girls. And my mom and I really became interested in the story, primarily because Leroy was her hometown when she was a girl, and secondarily because it was the birthplace of Jell-O. And, you know, her family had ties to Jell-O, and she had experienced a lot of the similar symptoms to these girls when she was younger, especially sort of in her late adolescence and early 20s. So the story was really enticing to us, and I ultimately ended up braiding it into the memoir because it felt like it performed a lot of what I was trying to say with the book. My mom did feel that the girls were responding to the way of living as a girl in a patriarchal culture, specifically a nexus of patriarchy, which is how she saw Leroy. So it was, I mean, she was very sure that that's what was going on. In the book, I'm less sure, but I'm certainly open to the possibility.
Well, that was something we wanted to ask you today, you know, when Mom and I were talking about this book last night. The kind of diagnosis or the accepted explanation for these girls was that I think one of them actually had Tourette's and then the others were sort of hysterically imitating that. That not consciously, but mm-hmm. subconsciously imitating. Did I get that right?
Well, there was one girl, and she had been apparently sort of a popular girl in the school who did have Tourette. The idea is that these conversion disorder is sort of the literal conversion of emotional stress into physical symptoms that the person experiences as involuntary. And they can spread similar to sort of like yawning or other mirroring symptoms that we all experience amongst tight-knit groups. And that would be mass psychogenic illness. So yes, like one girl had the original symptoms and then other girls sort of caught on from there.
And in a sense, they're being told it's all in their heads.
I think that was the parents' fears in a way. I would say that in terms of looking at the history of the girls in Leroy from 2011 to 2012, there was a lot of emphasis on making sure that there was no known physical cause for their symptoms and ruling those out before they said it was stress. Stress-induced and very real, but also emotional.
Right.
And I think, where a lot of the times, especially in women's experiences with a medical institution, the idea that, like, something is stress-based could feel like a way of being brushed off, and I think it oftentimes is. You know, if doctors don't know what causes something, they oftentimes say it's emotional or stress-based, and that can feel frustrating. I do think that for the girls, that probably was true, primarily because, you know, once the media attention started to wane and things settled down a little bit, the girls did get better. And, you know, also adding to that, that all of them had experienced significant life traumas prior to the onset of their symptoms. So I think, like, it was a tricky situation because, of course, like, the girls' parents wanted to protect them from being called hysterical and from all of the baggage that goes along with that label, especially for women. At the same time, we live in a culture that diminishes or says, like, tends to think that symptoms that are emotional are less important. So it was a very complex situation, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I don't think that the girl's diagnosis was a brush off ultimately, but I think it had the potential to be, for sure. And I think parents were rightfully concerned that it would be.
And of course, your mother had direct experience of having symptoms brushed off that turned out to be very, very real.
Absolutely. So when my mom was in her early 40s and I was a little girl, she started to experience a series of odd symptoms that sort of onset around her cycle. And these turned quite violent. And, you know, she was vomiting every month with every period. It was way worse than sort of your the run-of-the-mill PMS that doctors wanted to say that she had. So they offered up PMS as a solution. They offered up, you know, a myriad of different, like, allergies and other small, you know, stress, things like that. But, you know, after she persisted and finally found a doctor who would do an exploratory surgery, it came out that she had cancer and that, you know, it had almost killed her while she was waiting around for the doctors to do something about it. And I think this, you know, her experience is not, unfortunately, too uncommon.
Right.
Right.
Right. And your grandmother also endured something similar.
Well, my grandmother died of breast cancer in the late 1950s. I wouldn't say, because I don't know, nor do I have any reason to believe that she was not believed when her symptoms began. But I do know that, you know, at the time there was very little that doctors knew to do for that particular disease. And I do think that if she had been older when it had begun, if technology had advanced just a little bit further, we might have been able to have her around longer. As it was, she died quite quickly of what I think would probably be, what I'm trying to say is what I think would probably be a fairly treatable disease at this point.
Wow.
Well, they have made tremendous strides in that field and in all fields of medicine. And we see they do things today they couldn't do 5 years ago.
And, absolutely.
So it's that happens.
Do you, having had both your grandmother and grandmother die, or, you know, have cancer fairly early in life, that must have a big impact on you.
Yeah, it does. You know, obviously I didn't know my grandmother and I wasn't around for her illness and death, but the legacy of it certainly hung over my head a lot as a child, and my mother's, of course. And my mom's, you know, grief really marked my experience of life with her. But then ultimately, like, losing my mom young in my life and, well before the natural, or what should have been the natural end of hers, you know, it's scary. It's, definitely something I think about more than I would like to, and more than a lot of people do. I think, like, in some ways, I guess I try to see it as a gift, in as much as I'm aware of our fragility, I suppose, and the importance of the present moment, I hope, in a way that maybe people who haven't seen death as early as I have are, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I would still rather have her around and have the peace of mind that, like, not all the women in my family so far have died of cancer.
Yeah.
Well, I think this, that I think writing this book and putting it out there is very important.
Yeah, thank you. It feels that way.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Allie Rowbottom, author of Jello Girls. So how, you know, growing up, did you like Jello? How much was Jello part of your life?
I mean, it just wasn't really, I suppose, the most I experienced it was just sort of out in the world. I have memories of, like, going to the salad bar at Stop and Shop in the late 80s, early 90s with my mom, and there was always Jello in the salad bar. And I enjoyed that. It wasn't something that we made at home, though. We were pretty, like, my mom was pretty healthy, I guess. She was very concerned about chemicals and dyes in food. When I was a little kid, she was always reading the ingredients to things. So Jell-O would have been something that she would have not stocked in the house for that reason. But it was something that was around enough. You know, I had it at birthday parties or at school, and normally when I did, I would, like, say something to someone about it, as, like, little kids do, like, about my family's connection to Jell-O, but nobody ever believed me.
Oh, that is funny. Of course, if you had stayed in Leroy, or they would have believed you, they would have known, probably.
Absolutely, but, you know, by the time I was born, my mom was very rarely going to Leroy. We only went a few times when I was a kid. It was just not her favorite place. And I think for good reason, it was sort of the site of a lot of trauma for her.
Now, you talk about how Jell-O was sort of, I don't know how to say this exactly, but was maybe really pushed the idea of women's role in the kitchen, keeping women in the kitchen, and how that didn't work out so well for the women in the family. So, and that Jell-O was sort of a symbol of patriarchy almost.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jell-O, like a lot of products that came of age during the Industrial Revolution and then, you know, beyond, I think that it was, although I think it was particularly invested in women's lives because it was a food product and women were the ones preparing food at that point in history. And for that reason, it was very invested in appealing to women who stayed at home and made recipes for their children and their husbands. And it was invested, therefore, in sort of preserving what was a particularly 1950s ideal of the nuclear American family, and it flourished for those reasons. It wasn't until sort of the divorce boom of the 70s that it lost its footing a little bit in terms of how it was marketing and to whom. For the women in my family, particularly my mom, all of this was really a symbol of an establishment that she wanted to live outside of. And it was more personally a symbol of what felt sort of like a family curse that was hanging over her head. The family that she came from, you know, the Jell-O family, there's a lot of general unhappiness, alcoholism, suicides, that sort of thing. So not to mention the early death of her own mom. And she really wanted to get away from all that, and getting away from Jell-O and its legacy felt like a step in the right direction.
And yet the money that came from that business is what allowed her to get away from it.
Absolutely. It was sort of a double bind that she was caught in for her entire life. I think that, I say this in the book, but it's a shame because she was a brilliant artist and she relied on that money in order to make her art. But I think for that reason, she had trouble selling and promoting and really owning her own artistic voice in that practice. She was always giving her work away instead of selling it. And it was, it always felt to me sort of like a symbol of this idea that she didn't quite know how to profit off of her work when it was funded by this wealth from Jell-O.
Mm. I was curious about something. You made a reference to the Rosenbergs,
yes.
And how something about the Jell-O box, but I didn't quite get that. What
sure.
was that?
So it's just a funny little anecdote, but the Rosenbergs use a cut-up Jell-O box to communicate. They wrote messages on it. The box was an imitation raspberry flavor, and it's still on display in a museum in Washington, D.C., I think.
Oh,
no, it's not on display. I think it's, like, locked away in evidence. Excuse me.
Of course, she was accused of being a communist in school because she spoke out about things, right?
Yeah, as a little girl, she would always tell that story. Her father was a pretty iconoclastic character, and so I think she was sort of parroting him in the classroom, and it got her in trouble. I mean, it got her in trouble primarily because Leroy, the town that she lived in at the time, was, like, very invested in its connection to Jell-O and, like, by extension, its connection to the sort of all-American ideal of the small town where everybody's happy and employed and everyone's prosperous.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the town may still be invested in that image of itself, although things have changed. But yeah, so as, you know, as a child, like, my mom was different and felt different. She had been born in Lima, Peru, and felt that she had sort of experienced the life outside of the small town and wanted more of it. So, you know, her difference felt like sort of like a very visible bruise in the town to her, I think. And once she got away, she felt better.
Yeah, because she, yeah, right, because she felt like she had already experienced a lot of things and she wanted to talk about it, but people weren't, you know, they weren't listening.
Yeah, that was particularly true after she, when her family went away to Europe for about
right.
a year and then came back.
Yeah.
I think, too, I mean, her experience was probably one that's fairly common among artists or just people who identify outside what we very narrowly consider the norm still
mm-hmm.
in small town America. And so it's not an uncommon experience, I don't think, by any stretch. But I do think that once she moved to New York and sort of began to create her own chosen family and to pursue her life as an artist and to pursue therapy, quite honestly, a path towards healing, I think that's what really changed her life and helped her to better it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Allie Rowbottom, author of Jell-O Girls, A Family History. Do you think it would have been any different if the family fortune had come from some other, like banking or some other thing other than Jell-O, which, you know, was sort of in your face all the time from TV ads and magazine ads?
I think it would definitely have made for a different book, obviously. I think that, you know, I don't think that it was Jell-O that caused any sort of family misfortune any more than I think that money causes misfortune. I think it doesn't. I think quite to the contrary. I think that there probably would have been problems and discords in the family that was specific to whatever other sorts of privilege and wealth that the family had, you know, come to. Jell-O is specific in as much as it was such a cultural icon and such an icon of America and American values. So for that reason, I mean, I do think that it was a unique place to, or a unique product to be connected to.
Oh, absolutely.
Was it your uncle that said that this was, there was a curse on the men of the Jell-O legacy?
That was my mother's cousin, John.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yes. And with whom she ended up having an affair when she was quite young. She was older. And, you know, this doesn't really make it into the book, but she was not the only one that he was running around with at the time. His own father was a pretty intense alcoholic and died young. His grandfather also died young and somewhat mysteriously. He had an uncle who had fallen or jumped from the Sheraton Hotel in downtown Rochester. So, I mean, he had certainly endured his own fair share of trauma. His sister ended up killing herself by jumping out of a window. So,
And
he died pretty young too, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, he died of cancer. So I think, you know, whether or not he really believed in the curse, it was something that lodged itself very firmly in my mother's psyche from having been told about it by him when she was a child. And it, you know, she tried to figure it out for a long time because her cousin had told her that the curse affected only the men in the family and that she was safe from it because she was a woman. Ultimately, she sort of started to feel like maybe she was not exempt because she was a woman. To the contrary, you know, she was actually more at risk because she was a woman and she was so susceptible to the really damaging messaging of living in a patriarchy as a woman, especially at that point in history.
Allie, would you like to read from the book?
Sure. I could read from the beginning, perhaps, if that's of interest.
That's perfect.
Okay. And how long would you like me to read for?
About 6 minutes.
Okay, sounds good. So this is just from the prologue of the book. I tend to like to begin at the beginning, just to make it clear.
It's a very good place to start.
Yeah, exactly. She leaned forward, mouth open for the wobbling pink Jell-O I steered toward her. Here comes the Jell-O train, I sing-songed as if she were a child and I her mother, piloting a spoon into my baby's mouth. She kept her lips closed over a laugh, focused on swallowing, and said nothing. Across the room, the TV flashed images of a main street somewhere in America, a dilapidated factory, faded red brick, a smokestack, and a plaque, the Jell-O Company, 1900 through 1964. My mother gestured, mouth still full, pointing at the screen, suddenly frantic. Today we're revisiting Leroy, New York, the newscaster said. Birthplace of Jell-O, where in late 2011 and early 2012, a group of girls suffered mysterious Tourette's-like symptoms with no known cause. The camera cut to old footage of the girls seated around a table, twitching, holding their own hands to stop themselves from flailing. Their eyes were rimmed in black liner. Their hair was neatly swept into headbands. Their lips were glossy and pink. Their mother sat beside them, tensed against the camera's gaze, as if reined in to compensate for their daughter's unbounded bodies. We had followed the story closely, my mother and I, the mystery of Katie Krautwurst, a senior at Leroy High School, who, in October 2011, awoke from a nap with her chin frozen. It jutted from her face at an unnatural angle. Her face was in spasm, her whole body twitching. Weeks later, her best friend Sarah took a nap and woke up similarly altered. She too was ticking, throwing her arms, jerking her head, stuttering. The girls were both popular, both cheerleaders. Both had neatly conformed to the ideal of girlhood in their community, where the football team reigns supreme and Jell-O salads are still served on holidays and at local church potlucks. And the other girls, the girls who followed, also falling asleep, also awakening changed. Those girls were cheerleaders too. But after a while, the numbers grew and the symptoms spread. Quiet girls like Lydia Parker were afflicted. One girl wasn't a girl at all, but a 36-year-old woman, a nurse. About this mystery illness, the media said many things. They said this is how it all started, and then offered theories of train wrecks and toxic spills, black mold in the classrooms, witchcraft in the woods. They said there is no end in sight, and talked about the diagnosis, conversion disorder, mass psychogenic illness, but always with a disbelieving tone, their faces floating on the television screen, disembodied heads in small side-by-side boxes. On other shows, the girls sat on sofas beside their mothers, answering questions and twitching the more violently the more they spoke. I know my daughter, Sarah's mother said. She's a normal, happy girl. There must be something physically wrong with her. The mothers insisted and the girls all agreed. A refrain emerged. They wanted the world to know they weren't crazy. Before this, Sarah stuttered, arms flailing as she started to speak. I was fine. As she convulsed, the other girls began to as well, their movements picking up until the couch was rocked by the violence of their bodies. We weren't afraid of them, though the nation was. In the years approaching my mother's death, she and I were fixated on these girls. We talked about every unfolding aspect of their story, hours on the phone about their lives, about our lives, about how our histories were entwined, about how we were implicated, how this mystery illness was part of a system of symbolism, one older than us, older than Jell-O, consumerism, and America itself, one older even than witchcraft, one as old as men and women and words. This illness and its attendant metaphors, my mother told me, were what she'd been trying to write about all these years. This, she says, was why she started her memoir in the first place. She pronounced memoir with a soft R, memoir, and talked about hers constantly. In fact, the book, almost as old as I was, sometimes seemed to me like my mother's second child, and I resented her flourished memoir for all the years she spent writing it, all the years she spent away from me. But until I got older, I never thought of her book the way she did, as a spell she wrote to stop her family curse and save herself. Her writing would reclaim her life story, she believed, and the story of her mother before her. Her writing would become a counter curse. I'll stop there.
Okay. Were there parallels made about these girls with the Salem witch trials?
I did make some in the book, in as much as, you know, narratives about this kind of mass psychogenic illness, formerly known as mass hysteria, oftentimes pin the root cause on something silly, such as squabbles over a man, as ultimately happened in the Crucible. So, you know, I talk about it a little bit. I think in previous drafts of the book, I had more material about it. And what was interesting about the correlation between the Leroy girls, who are living in an insular community, much like Salem, Massachusetts, at the time of the witch trials, and Salem, were that, you know, in Salem, there were multiple reasons for what had happened that, you know, history doesn't oftentimes remember. There was, like, this, like, strange grain fungus that causes ergotism and like weird neurological symptoms. So, you know, it's a story that we talk about a lot in the context of women behaving strangely, but not a story that we look at critically a lot of the time as sort of why does this stuff happen and not who was to blame, but just sort of curiously, I suppose. I think there's oftentimes a lot of blame that or sort of eye rolling that goes along with stories of outbreaks of MPI, when actually it's a crazy phenomenon that those experiencing it experience as involuntary.
So I'm curious as about why this is your first published book. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is my first book.
So why did you decide to take this on as your first major writing project?
This book was, it was the story that I had to write before I could write other things, I think. I mean, it was right there in front of me, and as a writer, it was a really good story, and not to tell it felt like that would be a silly decision. I wanted to tell the story, but I think that for many writers, there's that first story that needs to come out before the other ones can live and grow. So that was this for me.
Would you have, was it hard for you to do this because, I mean, that's not quite the way I want to say it, but the challenges of trying to complete your mother's memoir, in a sense, as opposed to writing your own story. Was that a difficult balance to achieve?
I would say that, I mean, yes, I worked so closely with her material that I oftentimes felt like it was sort of trying to overwhelm mine. But ultimately, I feel that although I'm interpreting her story here, and giving voice to her story, it does feel like the voice is mine and the work is mine for sure. But it was a challenging tightrope to walk because, she's a brilliant character, or was a brilliant character in life, and has the potential to sort of overwhelm this book instead of just be its fearless, brave protagonist. So it was a challenge for sure.
Did you use directly any of what she had written? Or did
No.
okay.
I'm trying to think. I did use, like a document, word for word from her hospitalization at the Austin Riggs Center. I used some quotations of hers from letters that she wrote to me, but it's all attributed. The rest is my writing for sure.
And did you start on this before she passed away?
I did, yeah. I didn't envision that the book would turn out to be the book that it did at the time, but I started writing it about 2 years before her death. But it wasn't until she started to really decline that a lot of the urgency, I think, that's in the book, and a lot of the narrative, for lack of a better word, came forward, and the book took shape around her death, really.
I wondered about all the history of the Jell-O. Is that documented in the museum? I assume there's a Jell-O museum somewhere.
Yes, there's a Jell-O Museum in Leroy, and a lot of the material that I touch on in the book is in there, yes. There's also, some great sources for Jell-O history, primarily a wonderful book by the author Carolyn Wyman, who does sort of like food history books that was so helpful to me as I was writing. And then I used a lot of old cookbooks and stuff that I ordered off of eBay.
I got to admit, I had one of those Jell-O cookbooks when I was first married in the mid-70s. And I remember feeling so proud of myself for all these incredibly diverse Jell-O recipes that I made.
Yeah, it's kind of a hard pro it's hard. It's a hard thing to make, honestly. Like, I wasn't quite aware, but I started trying to make some of the recipes and joys of Jell-O myself, and it was harder than I thought. So much of the marketing is around the ease of making Jell-O, but when you're working with Jell-O and like tuna fish or whatever else you want to put inside of it, it becomes really challenging.
Well, I definitely went towards the dessert Jell-Os, and
That's probably wise.
so they weren't that hard, but it was just, put them in a parfait glass or something. It just seemed fancy to me. And I still, to this day, one of my kids, like at Thanksgiving and Christmas, I will still sometimes make their favorite one, which was strawberry jello with chopped up frozen strawberries and whipped cream. And
that sounds good.
It is good. It's very fluffy and strawberry. But that's about the only time these days I buy Jell-O. So has Jell-O really declined as a, but I don't sort of buy packaged food much anymore. And I know there still are people out there who do because it's still on the grocery shelves. But has Jell-O's prominence really declined?
You know, I can't speak too much to beyond sort of conjecture for how Jell-O is doing as a company and a brand. But I do know that, you know, overall, in general, people, much like yourself, are buying less prepackaged food that takes time to make. Like, if people want to eat junk food, it seems like they're just buying it ready to eat.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I think that Jell-O's biggest sellers are sort of the sugar-free pudding cups that you see in the refrigerated section of the grocery store. It's still very popular with dieters. It has like a low Weight Watcher count. And so, you know, people are buying it a lot for that reason. And I think that's pretty much its primary seller.
Well, you can even buy ready-made Jell-O gelatin too, can't you, in little cups?
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Wow. And they have the Jell-O rings.
Yeah.
The Jell-O rings in the store.
Oh, do they?
I mean, there's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah.
And of course, it's interesting, you know, as we all know, Bill Cosby was a spokesperson for Jell-O for many years. And did you find it kind of ironic that he, you know, was an assaulter when part of the curse was for your mother was having to have endured sexual assault as a young woman and a girl as a girl.
I mean, yeah, I unfortunately it wasn't surprising to me. And I you know, I think that's probably the response a lot of women had to it. I know that people were shocked about Bill Cosby, but I didn't find it particularly shocking. I mean, I did find it, you know, writing a book about Jell-O's connection to feminism, I did find it, you know, pertinent, obviously, but I didn't find it surprising.
What would your mother think about the Me Too movement?
I think that she would probably bring to it the same verve and vehemence that she once brought to politics. She was towards the end of her life, a pretty ardent political activist. She canvassed for Howard Dean and Barack Obama and threw a lot of parties for them and was just extremely invested. She had a framed photo of the Obama family on her piano. So I think she would bring the same enthusiasm to the Me Too movement. I think she would be probably pretty essentialist, for lack of a better word, about a lot of the gray areas that, you know, we're currently dealing with. It's a complicated time, and it's a real, I think, moment for reflection and like a turning point for American feminism. But I think that she would probably just be so passionate that her passion would overwhelm a lot of the critical thinking that I think is very necessary at moments like these. But she would be an ardent supporter, is my answer.
And what about your grandmother?
I mean, since I didn't know her, it's hard to answer. I do think that her temperament was much sort of quieter and more reserved than my mom, by all accounts. So, you know, I imagine that she would be supportive, of course, but I don't see her as at all being, you know, at the forefront of any marches on Washington and so forth.
You're listening.
I was wondering if, oh, go ahead.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Allie Rowbottom, author of Jell-O Girls, A Family History.
So Jell-O Girls is, it could be the girls who were affected in the place where Jell-O was made, or it's the Jell-O Girls of the family, either one or both.
Yeah, I see Jell-O Girls as sort of, I say in the book at some point, you know, we're all Jell-O Girls. Like, we're all women living in America and in a specifically American patriarchy, and that connects us. So this idea of, like, the Jell-O Girl and Jell-O Girls in general pertains to all of us. We've all been shaped by the forces of the culture in which we live, the product that we've been told to consume or instructed how to make, and Jell-O is one of them, but there are others.
And there was an official Jell-O Girl in, what, the 20s, the 30s? When was that part of the advertising?
She first came on the scene in the early 1900s, around 1904, I believe, is the year. And she was a little girl who served as the face of Jell-O for quite some time. Her name was Elizabeth King. She was a real girl. Her name was Elizabeth King, and she was the daughter of one of the ad men who was in charge of making and marketing Jell-O to the people. And they had really been struggling to find, you know, an appropriate spokesperson for Jell-O, but Elizabeth King became the Jell-O Girl and was ultimately immortalized by Rose O'Neill, who designed the Cupid doll. She drew Elizabeth holding her Jell-O out to potential consumers, and the tagline that went along with many of Elizabeth's ads were so easy even a child can do it. So I think at the time, because Jell-O was still an unknown entity to the American public, advertisements were really focused on assuring consumers that the product was easy to make and it was convenient, and that dovetailed quite well with the onset of the Industrial Revolution and the disappearance of kitchen help from the homes of the middle class. So for a lot of American women who had previously been privileged enough to have help in the kitchen, they were suddenly sort of faced with making their mother's recipes or the recipes that they'd gone accustomed to eating, not knowing how to actually do so. So Jell-O stepped in as a nice, convenient food that even a child could make.
Of course, our definition of convenience has changed over the years, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, I got this story to tell about that fits into that. I grew up in Newton, Iowa, where the Maytag company originated, Maytag washers, and Mrs. Maytag, her husband was head of the company. She was a friend of my mother's. And once we were visiting with her, and she said, when I first got married, she said, we had, of course, I had someone help with everything, and so I just had to make the menus. And so every time I had Jell-O pudding as a dessert, I always had tried to have something very simple for the main course because I thought it must be very hard to make. She had no idea. That's a true story. That's a true story. I just thought of that when you were talking about that. You know, and that... And I was wondering too, do other countries have Jell-O, or is this just an American thing?
I'm sure they do, but I do know that it's a very American product. Gelatin itself originated in Europe in sort of the kitchens of the wealthy because it was so arduous to make before it became a convenient product. So where I know that, you know, there are Jell-O boxes on the shelves in grocery stores abroad, it's really a symbol of America, and it's a product that sells in America.
Yeah.
So, Allie, when you were, as you were going through your mother's writing, did you learn things that were surprising or shocking to you?
It's hard to answer that question because my mom started sharing her writing with me when I was quite young.
Ah.
So by the time I started to write this book, I was pretty well aware of the myriad traumas that she had endured, many of which did not make it into the pages of this book, I may add. Like, so, yeah, I wasn't too surprised. No, I think my surprise generally came from growing old enough to see the nuances in and amongst my parents' marriage and the different factors that contributed to that marriage's disillusion, which didn't feel particularly painful, but just interesting. You know, my lens has widened the older I've gotten, and I've been able to see multiple sides to the story.
There really was a sense of resolution in the story with your father coming around towards the end of your mother's life.
Yeah, I mean, it felt very poetic at the time.
Yeah.
and I would say, you know, my dad was really present and helpful and wonderful during my mother's the last sort of phase and months of her illness and ultimately her death. And that was a really healing experience, I think, for her and also for him, and to a certain extent for me too.
Was your mother very supportive of you becoming a writer?
Yes. Unequivocally, yes.
And how much do you think seeing her doing all that writing all those years influenced your decision to be a writer?
That's a really interesting question. I wonder, because, you know, I think I resented her writing a lot as a child, and I didn't glamorize it. I knew that it was just sitting for long, long periods of time. And so I didn't really picture myself as a writer, but it sort of became this unavoidable thing that I was so predisposed to, I guess. And I ultimately feel like writing chose me. It wasn't like I just decided to be a writer. It was like I had no other choice.
Well, I've heard other writers say that. And I've heard, I think, advice from writers that don't do it if you have any other choice.
I agree with that. It's not easy, contrary to what many people believe.
And, of course, publishing can be very challenging, too. Do you have a good getting published story or a painful getting published story?
I think I have a really good one. I've been really fortunate, I think, in both in my publisher and in the story of me getting published, I guess. I did pursue writing as a profession and sort of teaching as a supplementary income profession from an early age. I went to my MFA program straight out of college, and from there I went on to pursue a PhD. Which I mention only to say, like, I knew that publication was not something to bank on, and that, you know, writers have to have a supplementary income most of the time. So for me, that was going to be teaching. But I completed this book in my PhD program and had a fairly easy path to finding an agent and selling it.
So how did you find your agent?
I met my agent at Tin House, which is, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners know, is a writer's workshop in Portland that's held in the summers. They have a winter program too, but I was on scholarship to Tin House and met my agent there. I had been sort of speaking with a couple other agents, but it turned out that the agent I met at Tin House, whose name is Mariah Spence, she just really understood my work and really felt passionately about it, which I think is pivotal for writers and the agent relationship. And so we ended up working together, and probably about 6 months after we met, I was working on a draft of Jello Girls at that point, and she helped me sort of take it to the finish line, and we sold it about 6 months later to Little Brown.
Now, Tin House is also a magazine.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I have subscribed to that at times in the past and also met an editor from there at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop one mm-hmm. time. I don't know if she's still there, Michelle. I can't remember her last name now, but anyway, it's a really great environment it's a writer's magazine in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the workshop itself is really great. If listeners can swing it, I think it's well worth it. And they do offer scholarships. They're offering a wider range of scholarships and really trying to diversify their student body. So I think, you know, it's something to take a look at for sure.
Michelle Wildgen, that's who it was. She is, looks like, still executive editor at Tin House.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah, she was great. And so are you teaching writing now?
Currently, I'm working on my second book, and I'm teaching writing sort of sporadically for Catapult, which is I teach it online. It's a writing workshop platform out of New York.
Oh, cool.
That offers a lot of great classes. I love teaching for Catapult. I think I will begin to, I've just relocated to Los Angeles, so I think I'll probably begin to add some classes, LA-based classes to my schedule in the spring, but I'm not sure where yet. I'm not quite sure. But I'm anxious to get back into the classroom. I do miss interacting with students, and I think it's really helpful to my writing practice.
Well, we are
well,
out
I'm
of
sure
time.
Already?
Wow. So, Mom, do you have some closing words for us today?
Yes, I do. Sometimes you have to let people know what you stand for and let them know what you won't stand for.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Allie. It's a real pleasure. Jello Girls is
Thank you both for having me.
Jello Girls is a fascinating story from both
it
a
is.
Feminist perspective and just a story perspective.
Thank you.
If you ever wondered about Jell-O, this is the place to go to find out.
And we'll see you all next week on Writers' Voices.